I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Marco Rubio, during his first term as Florida senator, has rocketed to the top of Mitt Romney's list of vice presidential candidates. But as a new book shows, Senator Rubio comes from humble beginnings, an immigrant family, and an early career in politics spent climbing the ranks of local and state offices. I'll talk with Manuel Roig Franzia, author of The Rise of Marco Rubio. That's ahead on Intersection. Florida's junior senator, Marco Rubio, is a fast-rising star of the Republican Party. Rubio was elected to the Senate in 2008, defeating Governor Charlie Crist, who ended up running as an independent rather than a Republican. Now Marco Rubio is at the top of Mitt Romney's list of possible running mates. But as Manuel Roig Franzia writes in his new book, The Rise of Marco Rubio, the Cuban-American comes from an immigrant family with humble beginnings, and in his early political career was slow and methodical. But that's not how we think of Marco Rubio necessarily today. He's got huge star power. Roig Franzia joins me from Washington, where he writes as a journalist for The Washington Post. Great to have you with us.
Wonderful to be here.
So the big question everyone's talking about, is Marco Rubio going to end up being Mitt Romney's running mate? What do you get from the analysis that's out there in your own experience?
I think that anybody who wants to make a prediction about who will be the running mate is on a fool's errand. There is a ton of tea leaf reading. You can only imagine what it's like inside the Beltway where everything is amplified. But this is what's clear. There's no question that Marco Rubio is someone who the Republican Party in general and the Romney campaign specifically has their eye on. He's a star in the making. He has a following. And it would almost be malpractice not to at least give him a look as the running mate.
You know, so much about Marco Rubio's family has been focused on. He had said his parents immigrated from Cuba to the U.S. in 1959 when Fidel Castro took over. And documents later revealed his parents actually came to the U.S. in 1956. That was before Castro. And this got a lot of play because Rubio has his own book out, his own story, his own biography. And this kind of threw the Rubio camp into a little bit of a tailspin. Tell us about that.
Yeah, what happened is that in October, when I was starting to do research for this book, both myself and the St. Petersburg Times came across some documents that showed that the family came in 1956. Rubio had been saying that they came after Castro or 1959. It's incredibly significant because there's a big difference between being forced off of the island and coming prior to Castro and being more of a traditional migrant to the United States. It's a matter of being part of a group or not being part of a group and being just supportive of them. The other thing about it is it's just a simple fact-checking thing that journalists do all the time, right? You're a journalist, you know. Politician says something, and if you come across contradictory facts, you're obligated to report it. I have to tell you, when I first came across it, I thought that I had a typo in front of me, because I saw this document, said 1956. I said, wow, 6, 9, could have been somebody who got the number wrong. The reason that I thought it was wrong was because I had heard him say so often that they came after Castro.
Mm-hmm. And so how does that story inform his political ideology, his political identity, that story of coming to America for the historical family?
There's no question that he wrapped himself in the ethos of the Cuban exile community. It's something that resonates in Florida, and it's a big part of his political identity, this notion that his family could not go back to Cuba, this notion that they were leaving something behind, that they lost something. And I think that even to this day, he is still struggling to come up with an explanation for why he said one thing when the reality was the other. Even in his own book, he's talking about having come across this information weeks before our story ran, weeks before it was mentioned in the St. Petersburg Times, but he had done nothing to correct his official biography. You know, right there on his biography, it said on his website, came after Castro. If he knew that beforehand, why didn't he change it? That's one big question.
Now, you dug deep into Marco Rubio's early beginnings of his political career, where he got involved in local politics and eventually rose to the state legislature. Talk to us a little bit about Marco Rubio's formative days and what led him to get involved in South Florida politics.
You know, there's this myth about Marco Rubio outside of Florida, and it's fascinating to watch it evolve over the years. And it's this myth that he was a creation of the Tea Party, that the Tea Party formed him. In the book, I even talk about it in these sorts of terms. It's as if he had sprung whole cloth from a town hall meeting. In reality, Marco Rubio, from a very young age, from his early 20s, was involved in Republican establishment politics. He worked for the Dole campaign. He campaigned for the Diaz-Balarts. He ran for the West Miami City Commission, his hometown. He ran for the Florida legislature. He ran for the House speakership. It's a very methodical, step-by-step-by-step progression in politics that is contradictory to the sort of mythology that was formed by people outside of Florida around this guy who seemed to be bursting onto the political scene in 2010 with his spectacular win in the Senate race.
Well, talk to me about when he gets into the legislature, because he, as you said, did eventually become the Speaker of the Florida House and one of the youngest, if not the youngest of the Florida House. And he really came under the wing of then Governor Jeb Bush. Talk to us about that relationship and how he made this ascension into the heights of political power in Tallahassee.
Well, it begins even before Jeb Bush. The first mentor who you really see in the Florida legislature is somebody who you knew when you were up there, I'm sure, Johnny Byrd. This central Florida, slow-talking, ambitious leader of the Republicans. And he caught Johnny Byrd's eye. Rubio caught his eye by volunteering to be on the redistricting committee. Not necessarily the sexiest job in Tallahassee.
And a huge mess when you politically get involved in it. Redistricting, it can be kind of a nightmare.
It really can. And in those conference rooms where they figure out which block is going to be in which district and do battle over all those sorts of things, Rubio really got an education in the mechanics of politics. And he learned how you build it from the bottom up. The other thing he did was he had so much energy that he impressed Johnny Byrd, and Johnny Byrd wanted to make him a part of his leadership group. You know, I spoke with Mr. Byrd for the book, and one of the things he told me was that during these redistricting sessions that Marco Rubio had so much energy, tapping his feet, talking very, very quickly, that he told him that, geez, if you have one more Mountain Dew, we won't be able to control you. So I think that is something that you see over and over again with Marco Rubio, that he's somebody who just has more energy, more drive, more ambition than anybody else, and it's a force that just can't be stopped.
And he's really become known, though, for his close relationship with former Governor Jeb Bush, who was also in the leadership position in Tallahassee when Rubio was there. So talk to us about that relationship and how it affected Marco Rubio's political outcomes as he became more closely affiliated with Governor Bush.
Yeah, I think that they had a very close, described to me almost as father-son relationship by people who were up there in Tallahassee together. They saw eye to eye about policy, small government. They also seemed to have a real personal affection for each other. This was not just a political alliance, but two people who liked each other. And Jeb Bush is someone who has been pretty moderate on immigration issues. And it's interesting to see how later, as Marco goes on to sort of establish his own identity, his own sort of public persona as a candidate for the United States Senate, that he departs a little bit from where his mentor was. Remember, when Marco Rubio was in the Florida legislature, he wasn't the person who was talking about very restrictive policies on immigration. But when he starts running, he starts saying things like, he would have voted for the Arizona Papers, Please law. He's opposing the DREAM Act. And these sorts of positions have allowed people who are critical of him at the national level to question his political core.
Well, certainly Marco Rubio, a rising star, pegged definitely within the halls of Tallahassee. But there were also some missteps when Rubio was in leadership positions in Tallahassee. He came in with his own circle of friends, and some of them, including former State Representative Ralph Arza, kind of erupted with Arza making some racist remarks towards another lawmaker that got some attention. Rubio did a major renovation to the members-only dining area in the Capitol that got some attention for the amount of cost that it raised. And also Rubio came in with his own book of 100 ideas that he was really hoping to grab attention with that many of them ended up not going anywhere. So what's the viewpoint on Rubio's time in Tallahassee? Is it all success?
It can't be viewed that way. And in part, there's another governor who comes into the narrative here, and that's Charlie Crist. And Crist and Rubio were at loggerheads throughout Rubio's speakership, and it prevented both men from getting done the things that they wanted to do. And some of those things that you are referencing, the renovation that he completed, which was expensive, his expensive staff, all of those things really undercut the message that he was trying to preach in that book that he wrote, the 100 Ideas book, which was fiscal responsibility, small government, all of these sorts of real red meat policy positions. On the one hand, there they were, right there on paper. And here he comes into office, and one of his first acts is to spend a lot of money. Another interesting thing about that, though, is that was his reaction. His reaction was to fight back very aggressively against some of those people who were criticizing him for that spending. And this is another pattern that he has, because he is a very effective spinner, if you want to use that phrase, arguer, if you want to use that phrase. But at times, he will extend controversies because of his reaction. And in that case with the renovations, he wrote letters to the editor, he wrote op-ed pieces, he reacted very angrily to that, and it only served to keep that in the news longer than it might have been. And that was a mistake by a young legislator who should at that time have been bathing in all sorts of adulation because of his very impressive rise.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. Manuel Roig Franzia is a Washington Post journalist and the author of the new book, The Rise of Marco Rubio. I'm Mark Simpson. Tell us, what do you think about Marco Rubio? You can tell us on Facebook or Twitter. Find us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. You can shoot an email over to intersection@WMFE.org. Now, talk to me a little bit, Manuel, about how this not-so-great relationship between Governor Crist and Speaker Rubio, those tensions later moved forward and carried themselves onto the stage when both of those men were competing for a slot for the U.S. Senate.
I spoke to legislators who served with both those men, and they told me that Marco Rubio in private would confide to them that he felt Charlie Crist was not a true conservative. and that he was not adhering to those principles. And that concern that Marco Rubio had sort of undergirds everything about what the two of them did while they were both in power. Remember, property taxes was a really big deal at that time.
That was when Governor Crist said property taxes are going to drop like a rock under his policies.
Exactly. And Senator Rubio, then House Member Rubio, wanted to do some pretty big restructuring. He was even looking at replacing the property tax with a sales tax.
Right.
He even proposed a petition. There were all sorts of battles between these two men on talk radio shows. There was one instance when Marco Rubio was driving in Miami and he called in a show just randomly to criticize Charlie Crist. I spoke with people who like both of these guys, worked with both of them, and felt that the feud did not do service to either of them, and that it actually prevented the state from addressing this problem in a more effective way. And of course, it just gets worse when the two of them are running against each other in the Senate race. And Rubio is very smart because he recognizes that the Tea Party is for real. And he embraces the Tea Party. Early on, I spoke with people who were with him early on when he was way down in the polls, and they said he would drive miles and miles and miles, hours and hours and hours, to speak to a very small Tea Party group. Charlie Crist wasn't doing that. Charlie Crist was the front runner, and it was a big mistake for Crist to not recognize that this rising force.
Well, talk to us a little bit about that, because I do remember those early days in the campaign when Rubio was in the race, but he was basically a non-contender. And they were really trying to drum up access to Rubio to get him some press. I remember he came to Orlando, and we had a very long interview, which today is a hard thing to get. But at that time, Rubio was so far down in the polls that basically you could get free access to the guy. So basically, tell us about what happened that caused Chris to basically lose his lead and eventually run as an independent, leaving the Republican Party entirely. This was a really amazing reversal of fortunes.
Yeah. What Rubio did and what his staff did, his campaign team did, was very intelligent. What they did was push their message outside of Florida to the national media and to national donors. Why the national media and national donors? One, the national media had a completely different perspective on who he was. For them, he was a fresh face, somebody who was talking about conservative ideals, someone who was articulate. In Florida, those who had covered him in the House sort of thought of him as a deal maker, somebody who was an insider. In the national arena, he was an outsider. Secondly, that same message took hold with donors. And what the campaign was counting on was this ricochet effect, legitimacy outside of Florida bouncing back into Florida and translating into better press in Florida and to more support from the donors in Florida. And it worked perfectly. It was like a bank shot in a pool game.
So take us through the final days of the campaign, though. There was Kendrick Meek, right, who was campaigning against Marco Rubio as a Democrat. Crist was there as an independent, having left the Republican Party to avoid a primary fight with Rubio and still be in the game to some degree. And then Marco Rubio, who basically ended up being the battleship cruising through the ocean here. And basically, because there was a three-candidate race, no one candidate was able to mount a defense against Rubio.
It wasn't just that no one candidate was able to mount a defense. It was that it was very beneficial to have three candidates in the race. You don't have to get as many votes, first off. And secondly, it's helpful to Rubio to have Kendrick Meek there. Why? Because the voters who might have considered going for a moderate Republican like Charlie Crist might have stuck over there with Kendrick Meek. And Crist took from Meek, and Meek took from Crist. They split that baby, whereas Rubio was able to completely own the more conservative wing of the Republican Party. Strategists who were involved in that race came to think that Rubio was very intent on making sure that they did not kill off Kendrick Meek. He needed him in that race. He did stay in that race and survive, and it ended up accruing to his benefit.
So take us through Marco Rubio's first initial years in the U.S. Senate. What has been his record, and what has he achieved?
It's been remarkable how quickly he has become an incredibly important senator. Imagine, the United States Senate is this place that loves seniority. It's a place where people wait and wait for power forever. It's a place where you have Teddy Kennedy and Robert Byrd staying for decades. Here comes Marco Rubio, and what does he do? He does the same thing in Washington that he did when he was in Florida running for the Senate. He projects his message outward. How does he do that? He has a big Twitter following. He's courts the conservative blogs. All of that affirmation outside of the building has the same ricochet effect. It comes right back into the building, and it raises his stature inside the building. More stature inside the building raises his stature outside the building. It's this continuous loop that they handle brilliantly. And within months of being in the Senate, he's already one of the loudest and most respected voices on the debt ceiling debate. John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, references only one other lawmaker in a very critical news conference during the debt ceiling debate. It's Marco Rubio. It's amazing. People in Washington have been blown away by how quickly he has been able to establish himself as a leading voice in that party. And it's not only on fiscal matters. It's really on matters of immigration. And this will be the big, big test for Marco Rubio going forward. How does he thread that needle? How does he appeal to the conservatives who put him into office while also taking advantage of the fact that as a Hispanic, he at least holds the promise of bringing Latinos into the GOP?
But this is a really tricky place for Latinos who are Republicans who've come up against this before, because it's been the undoing in some cases. For instance, Mel Martinez, who was himself a U.S. senator, had his own confrontations with the Republican Party leadership when it came to immigration. And now we see a similar situation, another Cuban-American senator facing it again in the guise of Marco Rubio. Talk to us about the differences maybe between the challenges Martinez faced and now Rubio is facing.
Well, in some respects, Senator Rubio has a little bit easier path than Senator Martinez did, and I'll tell you why. There's a bigger recognition now of the force that is the Latino population in the electorate. There are more numbers, and there's more respect for that community. The hard thing for Senator Rubio is that he has to reconcile the positions that he took during the campaign with this softer message that he's trying to transmit now. He's talked about changing the tone of the way the Republican Party talks about immigration. That was important. That resonated with Latino activists who had been critical of the positions that he's taken. But I'll tell you one thing. I spoke to a lot of his football coaches. He was a football player in high school. He played in college. One of the things they told me is that he was quick. What does quick mean in the context of football? You get to the right place at the right place at the right time in a hurry. So he's been quick in politics. There's no question about that. Recognized the Tea Party. He's recognized other trends. But for once, he moved a little too slowly. And how did he move slowly? He brought up the idea of an alternative Dream Act. He had opposed the original Dream Act, said that it created a path to citizenship and would cause chain migration. So he was talking about this alternative, and it was getting a lot of attention. But he hadn't put it down on paper. And for once, he moved a little bit more slowly than the opposition. President Obama announced this big change in deportation policy, and that sort of cut off Senator Rubio before he could put this bill in. And then afterwards he said that, well, he might not be bringing up this bill. And the problem there is that it raised questions in the minds of some people about whether he ever intended to introduce the bill in the first place. Washington is a tricky place to operate.
Well, Manuel, what do we not know about Marco Rubio? We've been pretty much picking apart his political career here, but what do we not know about him?
His family history, which is so important to his narrative and so important to his political identity, is still being unraveled. And I came across some very fascinating documents about his grandfather. You know, he talks about his grandfather a lot. His grandfather came to the United States in 1956, the same year as his parents. And he is an example of an immigrant who came to the United States and it didn't work out so great. He was really struggling to make a living. He went back to Cuba after Castro came into power. Like a lot of Cubans, he thought Castro was going to be a leader who would improve that island and would make it a better place. And he actually ended up working with the grandfather for the government, a very low-level job in the transportation department. But he figured out eventually, as many did, that Cuba was heading towards communism, and he tried to come back to the United States. And in 1962, he was stopped at the Miami International Airport, and he was detained by immigration authorities because he did not have a visa. And this was an unknown, undiscovered piece of history that I was able to come across in the National Archives. And I found this amazing recording, more than 50 years old, a recording of a deportation hearing for his grandfather. Now imagine, here he was, a 63-year-old man, 7 daughters in the United States, a wife in the United States. And in 33 minutes of that recording, I'd learned that the United States government looked at him and said, you don't have a visa, you don't have a right to be here, and we are going to deport you, send you back to Cuba, back to this place that has been identified as an enemy of the United States. It was heartbreaking to listen to that, heartbreaking. And the relevance of it is that Marco Rubio will have a big say in how the United States handles deportation, both because he has a bully pulpit, so to speak, because people listen to him, and also because he's been active in negotiating these immigration deals with the Republican Party. And so you have to put that in context with what happened in his own family. And I'll be interested to see how he addresses that, since it's something that he never really has talked about in public, but that I deal with in great detail in my book.
A fascinating story, fascinating story. We've been speaking with Manuel Roig Franzia, Washington Post journalist, author of the new book, The Rise of Marco Rubio. Manuel, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at the Florida Talks blog. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.